Welcome to Solutions for the Underaffiliated, the show for people who want positivity, hope, and examples of improving the overall health of humanity. I'm Eric, and I'm with my co-host, Habanero. Dr. Worth Holtz is with us today. He's a physician with experience both delivering care and leading health system operations. He was also the deputy chief medical officer for a large health insurance company. Dr. Holtz was a pilot in the U.S. Air Force and a major general, and special assistant to the commander and deputy chief of staff in the United States Africa Command. Does that do you justice, Dr. Holt?
You're very kind. Yeah, that's me.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got into flying and being a doctor?
Oh, goodness. Well, I grew up in the healthcare industry. My father was actually a career employee of a pharmaceutical firm. And we grew up moving around the country quite a bit. In fact, it was almost like I imagined being in the service would be. So I think from a young age, I was always kind of destined to pursue life sciences and probably go into a healthcare career field. And that was always my aspiration. When I was fairly young, my orthodontist actually had an airplane and introduced me to aviation. It wasn't anything that was, common in our family.
Your orthodontist?
But of course. I went flying and became hooked and decided to take money that I earned cutting grass as a teenager and things like that and funnel it into something that... At that point in time, in the 70s, late 60s, 70s, was more productive than some of the other things that I could have probably gotten involved in. And so I started flying as a civilian at a very young age, got a pilot's license, and used that and working as a flight instructor and a commercial pilot to work my way through school and medical school. Eventually, I wanted to fly the highest performance aircraft that were available, and of course, that was through the military. In fact, going into the Air Force and the Air National Guard was rather selfish, to tell you the truth, because it was all about flying airplanes. That's what I wanted to do. And it wasn't until much later that I developed what I would call a more profound sense of patriotism. And all the while, I was pursuing my medical education. So my career sort of morphed into finding a way to either do the two things in parallel or combine them in some kind of a productive endeavor.
So you were flying jets and learning to practice medicine around the same time, like simultaneously?
Yes.
Holy yes, I was. Crow. And,
that's pretty incredible.
Well, you know, it was a lot of monitoring instrumentation, manipulating technology.
Never sleeping.
Yeah, that's true. But it just when you're doing something that you really enjoy and that you want to do, it doesn't seem like a burden at all. And so I felt really fortunate. I had kind of focused on a career in surgery. But then I had to go active duty in the Air Force for my military training. And I went to some fairly remote places, both in this country and abroad, and gained an appreciation for primary care. And I found out that in some areas, you know, what they really needed were general internists and family physicians and pediatricians. And so ultimately, my training focused on family medicine and emergency medicine.
So when you were in the service, where did you serve? And was there a specific time when you were engaged in combat exercises?
Well, I spent 36 years. So I've been pretty much everywhere. And my flying activities were focused initially in the F-4 Phantom, and then later on, and for most of my career, in the F-16. And as a result of that, I've been all over the world. I've participated in most of the major exercises. You know, really had an opportunity to see some extraordinary things. And, you know, the it was interesting as I traveled around. I mean, I met a lot of extraordinary individuals, and it certainly shaped my perceptions and my thoughts about the world in general and life events and my role and ways to, again, apply healthcare and yet participate in the kinds of activities to, you know, sustain a peaceful, productive, quality lifestyle. I think that's sort of how I've melded the two together from a rather philosophical standpoint, as it were.
Right. I was going to ask you a little bit about that. You know, as you think about what it means to defend the country and what it means to be a family physician, you know, in some cases, especially on the side of being in the military, you're going to have to do some things that, you know, the call of duty says you may not want to do, especially with a jet. How do you balance that desire to care for people with that oftentimes violent need to defend the country?
Well, let me back up again. You know, as I said, I went in to fly airplanes. And right. I think if you talk to most pilots, that's what they would tell you they went in for. Now, they use that skill set to support, you know, our country, our values, our way of life. So it started out as being the freedom of being able to move in three dimensions, no stop signs, no speed limits for all practical purposes. You know, as we used to say, slipping the surleys. And I mean, the stuff that we saw was spectacular, but then we were able to use that again, to protect those things that that we hold dear. And when I look at my role as a physician, I was primarily concerned about quality of life, not so much quantity, but quality of life. And our way of life, or at least the way of life that I've become accustomed to, is synonymous with quality of life. So when you think about, you know, how could I be in a role that some people would characterize as a conflict, if you will, or a contradiction between the healer and the hunter. On the other hand, I rationalized it by, you know, the notion that I was out in both cases trying to improve, sustain, protect a way or a quality of life. And I still feel that way. I still feel that way. Again, it's been extraordinarily exciting. And then over the course of the career, you know, I did have opportunity to be involved in the development of a pilot physician program in the Air Force, where we could use our medical skills and knowledge to improve the interface between the human factor, the pilot, as it were, and the technology, the aircraft, find ways to more effectively utilize the technology and, you know, and exist in an environment that is violent, not just from the perspective of what's going on around you, but it's violent physiologically, the forces on the human body,
right.
And the way that your body, your eyesight, your breathing, your cardiovascular system reacts to those forces.
Let's focus a little bit on the doctor side of you. What are some of the things you're seeing in healthcare today that are just constantly on your mind?
Well, again, not to get too long-winded, but I've had a long medical career and it spanned everything from direct patient care to administrative responsibilities and delivery of healthcare on a large scale. So we think about the new technologies, which are extraordinary. We think about measuring outcomes, the things that we're doing really improving quality of life and healthcare overall. You know, we talk about the regulatory environment, vaccinations, but on any given day, when I come home and sit down and talk with my wife, who's a dentist, in fact, she pointed out to me that more often than not, I'm lamenting on the problems with access to care. So my number one thing is access to care.
So what does that mean for folks when a doctor says access to care? What do you really mean? Like, does that mean that they can't get there? They can't get in the door? They can't afford it?
Well, it's all of the above. In retirement now, I'm doing a lot of part-time work in urgent care, emergency care environment. And I see people every single day that I'm working that say, well, we're coming to see you because we couldn't get in to see our personal physician. They said the next opening was 3 or 4 weeks away, or I don't even have a personal physician. And I'm not sure that that's the best way to manage healthcare in right. this sporadic, urgent care, episodic type environment. We'll take care of the laceration, the broken bone, the cold, but there's so much chronic illness that is probably not managed as well as it could be. And that has a lot of ill effects on an individual's, you know, life and longevity. I think right along with that, there are some issues about accountability for healthcare. I don't think anybody would argue that most of us probably don't take care of ourselves as well as we do. We engage in a lot of destructive personal behaviors, whether it's smoking or what we eat or lack of exercise or risky activities. And that has a tremendous impact on your overall health. So those are the kind of things that I see and deal with on a daily basis that, you know, give me pause for concern.
One of the things that I hear about with local community social media is people who don't have access to healthcare and they're afraid to go because they know they're not going to be able to afford the bill. So they wait until it is an urgent situation.
There's no question about it. And that's just so unfortunate. And we loop that in with what's commonly called social determinants of health now. There are folks that don't have adequate access to food and shelter. They don't have companionship. And all of these things impact your overall health and well-being. And it's very difficult to deal with when they can't access the health system. They don't have a physician. They don't have an advocate, if you will.
Tell us a little bit about the patients that you see, and also how have you maintained a positive worldview over your career, just having seen so much of the way people are in different walks of life?
Well, that's quite a question. I think that certainly having been overseas, I've seen some tremendous challenges that people endure. And quite frankly, most every country that I've ever been to, even the poorest, the vast majority of people are happy. And it gives me great perspective on how fortunate I've been and my family and the people that I know back here in our country. I love everywhere I've been, but I'm always glad to get back home. And that perspective helps me to appreciate things. It helps me to avoid taking things for granted. And it encourages me to take care of myself and do everything that I can to benefit from, I don't know, I guess for lack of a better word, the blessings that I or we have been granted. But again, it is kind of fun when you go overseas and you see so much happiness and so much richness, and people want to tell you about themselves and their cultures. They want to share with you. And that has really helped me as a family physician in my interaction with my patients. They come in and they have challenges, and I like to share with them about, let's focus on those positive things. You know, we can take care of these little problems. You know, let's try to focus on what we can do to live a better life moving forward.
So how do people respond if and when you tell them things like, hey, maybe you should eat different, or maybe you should engage in a little bit more physical activity? Because you said before the break a little bit about how we all should be accountable for our own health, at least to some degree. You mean there's certain things we can't control. It could be our income, so we can't afford the foods we want. But how do you handle that in a positive way with folks?
Well, you know what? People come to you asking for help. And, you know, most of what you do can only help them, can only lift them up, can only give them hope for the future. So, yeah, nobody wants to be told for the 1,000th time that they need to quit smoking. But they all know that. And they don't seem to get angry if you say that. But I frame stuff up like there's always the opportunity to, you know, cut out some of that extra food. Get out there and walk a block. You don't have to run a marathon. Just little things, activities, getting out. And any little thing that you can do to improve your overall health is a step in the right direction. And people seem to take that in a positive light. They seem to like being told that they can get better, they can improve, as opposed to taking a punitive approach like some people might, where you scold them for their destructive behaviors. So I avoid that.
Right.
But I see people in need all the time, and I want to help them.
Describe your patients a little bit. Is it just everybody that you see, all walks of life, or does it tend to be more seniors or families? You said you're a family physician.
I am a family physician, but as you pointed out earlier, I don't know, I'm in like my third retirement now. So. but I'm doing some part-time work with a system that I used to be involved with, and it's urgent care focused. And we do a little bit of occupational health. But surprisingly, the industry in general, and because of a variety of things, people have been pushed into the urgent care environment for more of their healthcare needs. And I'm astonished at the acuity of care, meaning the severity of things that I see in what we used to call minute clinics that were really set up to take care of minor illnesses. But I see major lacerations, chest pain, heart failure, lots of broken bones. And the patient demographic is across the board from, you know, newborn babies to the elderly. It's a real challenge. At the same time, though, it's tremendously rewarding. The variety is very interesting, and it's challenging at the same time. I also see a lot of different cultures. It's amazing how often I have to use an interpreter or sometimes just figure it out by looking at the individual and using body language to communicate with them. We have a lot of immigrants of varied cultures. I just can't imagine how frightening that must be. I know that when I've had to go to the hospital or see the doctor, it was frightening to me, and I knew how to navigate the system. So I look at all of these vulnerable populations, and I realize it's got to be incredibly frightening to them to be in that environment and have communication issues as well.
As you see these folks, are there any themes you're seeing that, again, think about when you go home and you go, if I look at all these different data points that come my way, over the course of a day, a month, a year, are there themes you're seeing that would be helpful for other Americans to think about?
In terms of healthcare issues, certainly there's a huge prevalence of cardiovascular disease, obesity. You know, this is nothing new. In terms of presenting problems, it tends to cycle during different parts of the year. You know, we're getting into the flu season now. We're going to be seeing a lot of respiratory illnesses for several months. In the summertime, it seems like I spend half my time pulling fish hooks out of people's arms and things like that. You see a lot more trauma, a lot more lacerations as people get back outdoors. But again, it's rich, and I feel so fortunate to have the skill set and the opportunity to deal with this wide variety of illnesses that is the same for everybody, no matter where you come from or what you do.
So how did you get into you said urgent care. How did you get into urgent care after practicing medicine where, you know, people come in by appointment and it's probably very structured and it's, I don't want to say easier, but it's certainly less complicated.
Well, originally I just wanted to volunteer in teaching resident physicians. So these are docs that have finished medical school, but now they're training in a particular specialty. And in the case of family medicine, it's a 3-year training program. And I knew at this system where I used to work, there was an opportunity to volunteer and help out. So I started doing that. And then I was asked by some of the faculty members if I could help out and actually see patients in the urgent care centers that handle a lot of overflow and those emergent needs, as I mentioned earlier. I was kind of concerned that I would be able to do that, but I found that with a little bit of help and some reading and study, I was able to jump back in almost as though I had never left. And again, the breadth of challenges that were there, the opportunity to help people was fascinating to me. And then they asked me to do some more. And the next thing I knew, I was working half time again.
I have a question. So I know that one of the things that's been happening in the institutional world is they've been discouraging people, they call them the frequent flyers, from coming into the emergency room. And there's very strong, instead of using the emergency room as your primary care, they're trying to direct people to primary care. But I feel like the way you're describing it, people don't have access to primary care. So the urgent care has come up as a in between the emergency room and having and being able to access a primary care.
You're absolutely right. And as a result, the urgent care environment is looking more like the emergency room every single day.
I have another question. You know, there's all these miracles of modern medicine that we have, all these drugs, all these procedures. You talked about cardiovascular. It's amazing how they can like get in there and just replace these tiny little pieces of a heart that might not be functioning properly, or revive people from heart failure, a heart attack, a stroke. And how much do you think that increased longevity kind of allows people maybe to experience more chronic stuff that didn't kill them the first time through? And what you're trying to manage is, you know, helping people after something that didn't lead, you know, would have killed them in the past.
Well, my own parents are in their 90s. My mom has severe dementia. My dad is actually still very active, and they're both with us because of some of those technologies. On the other hand, we see a lot more things, as you point out, that in the past we probably never would have seen because the individual wouldn't have lived that long. They say if you live long enough, everybody's going to get cancer sooner or later.
That's exactly the kind of thing that I'm thinking about, whether it's, you know, calcification of your arteries or breakdown of your physical infrastructure, bones, cartilage, you know, that chronic pain kind of thing.
Who do you see? Is it more seniors? Are you seeing more senior folks in the urgent care, or is it a cross-section of society?
I see a cross-section just because, again, the access to care issue. I definitely see more seniors with more severe illness than I might have 20 years ago.
Okay.
No doubt about it. But it's just as likely for a young baby to come in with some lesions, a rash that the parents are concerned about, that is something as innocuous as hand-foot-mouth disease, which is just a viral infection that's self-limited. We see everything, but that's what makes it fascinating.
Why do you think there's this access to care problem that's causing more folks to wind up in an urgent facility?
Well, I think that healthcare is complex. I think that there are some perverse incentives. You know, most of healthcare is paid for by the government now, at least indirectly. It's through the carriers that is largely a for-profit industry. I think that when healthcare is driven by profits, that leads to certain outcomes. Now, I certainly have no issue with investors wanting a return on their investment. And I think that capitalism has allowed us to develop some of these extraordinary technologies. We've been able to accelerate the development of vaccines, for instance, at a pace that was unheard of. At the same time, though, there are lots of examples where maybe healthcare being driven by profit doesn't directly benefit the patient or the physicians and nurses that are responsible for delivering the care. We see a lot of burnout as a result. We see people that are overworked. In many cases, they certainly feel that they're underpaid, and in a lot of cases, I think they are. We see excess capacity out there that's underutilized in terms of buildings and places that the healthcare dollar is going to that don't directly benefit anybody. So you begin to get a shortage of physicians. You begin to get a shortage of nurses. That creates access issues, and it puts a greater burden on emergency rooms and urgent care centers where I'm at.
Same thing here. It's really bad where we are.
And that's not, again, that's fine for a bona fide urgent problem. It's not so good for the management of chronic illness like diabetes, heart disease, renal failure, you know, things of that nature, and back pain for Pete's sakes. You know, you can't imagine how often we see somebody come in for back pain that they've had for 6 or 9 months.
So as you talk to your residents, as you talk to your peers, What are some of the things that are going through your mind to help solve some of this or you know, get us out of this?
Well, we've tried to focus on preventive medicine, if you will, and encouraging better health and identifying other resources in the community to manage all kinds of issues. We've tried to focus on social determinants of health. We know that if somebody can't get food, they're likely to have more problems. We know that if they don't have social interaction and support in the community, the incidence of mental health issues rises. And mental health is a tremendous challenge that we don't do a very good job of addressing. And it certainly leads to other forms of illness as well. I try to tell my residents to address these issues. I certainly talk to them about a balanced work style, but I'm also upfront in that this is a difficult, challenging, busy lifestyle. I mean, it's a labor of love for sure, and they need to be prepared for that.
It feels a little bit like we're asking the clinical community to fix social problems that perhaps are well beyond the scope of what's taught in medical school.
Oh, I think that's spot on. Of course, I would come back and I would say, well, who better to address it? Who better to recognize that? There was a time with one of my former employers where we began putting, we worked with the food banks because we were so concerned about the impact of food insecurity on overall health. And then we found that we could take food, we could create packages and put them in the primary care physician's office. It was shocking how often if we had a patient in a room and we asked them directly in a, you know, a private environment, if you will, do you need food and would you like some? We were just blown away by the number of people that said yes and took the resources, the food, the groceries that we had to offer them.
Wow. Extraordinary.
That is extraordinary. Do you think that doctors should bear all the burden for fixing these societal problems, or do you think it's a shared responsibility? And if so, how should we all be thinking about our shared responsibility and accountability for improving the health in America?
Well, I think it's absolutely a shared responsibility. I think that doctors are in a position to see it early on, perhaps when others can't, but physicians are burdened with so many problems and challenges. There's no way that you can hold physicians responsible for addressing it completely. So I see us more as, folks that are in a position to identify it. We can try to help. I think we can be a clearinghouse for certain types of community resources. But I think that everybody in the community has a certain responsibility for stepping up and addressing the needs of those around them.
One of the things that has come up on this show a lot is the role of managed care and insurance companies and a lot of finger pointing. And the finger pointing comes from the fact that you either have a high premium, you have a high deductible, you have a high copay, can't afford to go to the doctor, I put off care, and that's what you end up seeing, and it's the insurance companies to blame. How should folks think differently, if they should, about that narrative?
Well, again, I see the insurance companies as a conduit, if you will, for healthcare delivery. I don't think that it's appropriate to hold them responsible for all the angst in the healthcare world. I think that you can argue just as effectively that they're responsible for the good things that we have. As I mentioned earlier, I think that the way our healthcare is reimbursed, while it's had some unintended consequences of, healthcare delivery being driven by profit for investors. But on the other hand, we have been able to develop extraordinary technologies and get out to places and people that we might not have otherwise. And the federal government or whoever it is cannot single-handedly cover the extraordinary expense of healthcare. So we need the insurance industry. We need nonprofit healthcare systems to provide access to the care. It's just that currently it's not meeting the need, and I'm not sure it ever will, frankly.
One of the things that Eric's brought up before when this conversation has come up, and it makes a lot of sense, is doesn't the insurance company look at a slightly bigger picture that if they don't make care accessible in the early stages of disease, it's going to cost them so much more in the later stages? Like, why are they not making that that connection, that's one of the things that I don't understand.
Well, in the industry, we used to talk about how long an individual patient stays with a given, we'll just say insurance carrier in this case. And when patients were changing carriers every 2 or 3 years because they went to a new job or a new location and they had to get a new carrier for healthcare, then there was the thought that there wasn't much point addressing those illnesses and conditions whose outcomes weren't manifest 15 or 20 years.
Okay, so they didn't have to spend the money today.
They're getting a lot smarter, and they're recognizing that, well, wait a minute, even if you bounce to somebody else, there's also a patient that's coming back to me as a carrier, and we all ought to work to address chronic health issues and preventive health, because ultimately it is going to have an impact on the services that we deliver and our financial performance.
That
also
is...
you have a lot of people that are staying with a carrier for much longer now, 5, 6, 7 years instead of 2 or 3. And there are many illnesses which, you know, you can make a measurable difference in the outcome and the expense associated with it, even over the course of 5 or 6 years.
How much of that do you think came from the change in the regulations a few years ago that said you cannot deny someone because of a pre-existing condition? Because when you just explained the theory with the insurance companies, they're only going to be with us for a couple of years, and the new people who might come to us, we could get them on pre-existing and not have to pay for that. It's all about the money. That's what it feels like sometimes.
Well, I think it does feel like that sometimes. It feels like that a lot of the time.
We do talk a lot about the role of profit. You've mentioned it, and I think it's clear. I think there is too much of an emphasis on profit, and it's detrimental to care. By the same token, two things have come up here. One is people are living longer, and as people live longer, there's the costs of care grow. I mean, they just grow because you're caring for people who are older. The other one is chronic conditions, and chronic conditions start to emerge in your 30s, in your 20s, and that drives the cost of care. And so I'm very comfortable saying that profit can lead to problems, not just in healthcare, but in other aspects of our society. But there's a human element in demand here. There's it's not like consumers are sitting here going, wait, I'm not sick, it's expensive.
But we also know that the vast majority of healthcare expense, maybe 80, 90%, occurs in the last month of somebody's life.
Yeah.
And perhaps there are futile therapies that are extremely expensive that we are using inappropriately at the end of life. But back to the technology, on the other hand, there are technologies like CAR T therapy now, where there are some cancers that we can actually cure. We can do amazing things that were not even imaginable 20 or 30 years ago. So there's a lot of expense associated with technology that maybe is inappropriate and then occurs later in life. But there are other tremendous benefits that we've reaped as a result of, you know, the for-profit industry, the science industry that has gone out and learned and developed methods of helping others and addressing chronic illness that, again, we couldn't have imagined just a short time ago.
I love that you ended on a positive note like that, because it's really important, I think, for folks to understand that there are plenty of negative things we can point to in the healthcare system, but it's really helpful and I think important to talk to someone who's seen so much of the world and can look at things through a lens of let's be positive and look at the good things while we're addressing some of the negative things. So I really want to thank you for taking the time to be with us today. It was a great conversation.
I really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. Check out all of our podcasts of this show and the blog at underaffiliated.com and stream Asheville FM live from the site or the app. Thank you very much, everybody. Have a great day.